Another one, and then we'll go into the question and answer session. This one comes from Middle America. A man lived in a city with many synagogues, but then moved into a small town. Only had one synagogue, so he had no options, and he joined our synagogue. When he went to service on the Sabbath and sat through the service, in a Jewish service in the synagogue, at some point you recite the Shema. The Shema is the Deuteronomy 6 Hear Israel prayer. And when it came time to say the Shema, this big debate broke out within this Jewish community about how to say the Shema. Do we say it standing or do we say it sitting? First of the service, all they do is argue back and forth on how to say the Shema. He figured it was a bad Sabbath, it'll be better next week, and so he came back next week. But if again, as soon as it came time to say the Shema, all they do is argue and they'll say it standing or sitting. Now, I should mention the background to the story is the fact, the observation that Jewish people like to argue among themselves. As a Jewish saint, if you have two Jews together, you'll have three different opinions. And this is not the part of the story, but another story illustrated that Jewish people argue with their hands a lot, in the story of two New York Jews on the streets of New York in the winter. And one is arguing, going back and forth, arguing, and finally says, "Sam, you argue for a while, my hands are cold." So the man went to see the president of the synagogue and said, "Isn't there a member, an older member here that might have been here when the synagogue was first planted? Maybe that member remembers what the first tradition was. Do we say the Shema standing or do we say the Shema sitting? And let's just agree, whatever the first tradition was, sitting or standing, we will go with that first tradition and stop arguing every week." And the president said, "You know, the rabbi who began the synagogue is still living. He's in the Jewish old age home. He's still very lucid, so go talk to him and see what he says. And yes, we agree, whatever the first tradition was, that's the one we'll follow." So he went to see the rabbi and said, "Rabbi, I joined the synagogue you started, but I have to tell you I'm very, very disappointed. Because week after week we have a big argument on how to say the Shema. So I came to ask you what the first tradition was. Was it to say the Shema standing?" The rabbi said, "Say the Shema standing? No, that's not our tradition. If you say the Shema standing, you may as well convert to Christianity. No, we don't say the Shema standing." The man said, "In that case, the first tradition was to say the Shema sitting." The rabbi said, "Say the Shema sitting? No, that's not our tradition. If you say it's sitting, you may as well convert to Islam. No, we don't say the Shema sitting." The man said, "Rabbi, I'm confused. I came to ask you what the first tradition was, because Sabbath after Sabbath after Sabbath, all they will have is a big argument. Do we say it's sitting? Do we say it's standing? Every week it's a big argument, a big fight." The rabbi said, "Now that's the tradition." Okay, some written questions, which I'll deal with first. Note the questions from the floor. "Did you see Left Behind?" I did not see the Left Behind. I did not read the Left Behind series, not because I'm against it. I simply don't have time to read novels of any kind. I think, as I mentioned, I like what he writes, and his prophetic scheme behind the storyline is very accurate. And so I do believe that he presents it accurately. His books portray the gospel. Many people have come to faith because of these Left Behind books. And so I have not read it myself. My wife has read some, but I have not simply had the time to read it myself and don't know if I will, because there's some other books I want to get through before I get to heaven, so we'll see. "If the church age believers are going to be judged at the judgment seat, when are the Old Testament believers going to be judged?" Now, the purpose of judging the church saints is because for the purpose of determining their degree of authority in the Messianic kingdom. But the Old Testament saints will not have positions of authority in the kingdom. The Old Testament saints will live within the borders of the land of Israel, and church saints will be co-ruling with Jesus over the Gentile peoples and nations worldwide. And so there's no need to have a special judgment for Old Testament believers, because they're not being determined for rulership it is the church saints that will co-rule with Jesus over the Gentiles, so there's no special judgment for that reason. Will the Jews, as friends of the bride and groom, rule along with the church, each believers, as the bride of Christ in the millennium? Again, Israel itself will be within the land of Israel, and they will have Gentile servants, that they will not rule over Gentile kingdoms or cities and societies. That is something God has reserved for the church to do, and that Israel will not be doing so. The blessing for the Jewish people will be to finally indwelling and enjoying peacefully all of the land. The renovation of the universe as it is known and the creation of the new heavens and the new earth, the new Jerusalem, will Jews primarily occupy the new earth, since most of their promises deal with earthly things, sand, the sea, stars of the heavens. Insofar, sometimes people have made the distinction as the Jewish people have the earthly blessings, the church has the heavenly blessings, but actually both have an earthly and heavenly future. In the Messianic kingdom, both Israel and the church will be here on earth in different roles, but they'll be here on earth. In eternal order, both Israel and the church will be in the heavenly New Jerusalem. So both groups have both an earthly future and a heavenly future. The earthly future in the kingdom will be for different roles, and while distinctiveness is maintained for eternity, no functional differences are spelled out anywhere. So probably there won't be any functional differences, just identity differences. Okay, that's all the written questions that came in, so I'll take the questions from the floor. If you have a question, raise your hand. We'll go from there. Somebody got the mic today? Okay.
I have a question. I hope I can word this plainly. The Old Testament promises you talked about tonight, Jeremiah 31:31 and 24:7. There are those who say to me those promises in the Old Testament belong only to the Jews. Are any of those promises for believers? Are they all for Jews? Or how do we know the difference?
Well, the four covenants we dealt with this evening are Jewish covenants made with Israel. Now, the covenants he made with Israel contain both physical promises, like the promise of the Lamb, and spiritual promises. Now, the physical promises were limited to the Jewish people only. So the church does not partake of the physical promises. The church does partake of the spiritual promises. That was already promised in the Abrahamic covenant, in Genesis 12:3, in you all the families of the earth be blessed. Now, this is a good passage. Turn with me to Romans 15. Romans 15. The term that Paul uses for how much the Gentiles participate is the word partaker. The word partaker. And he uses it, for example, in Ephesians chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. That the Gentiles now partake with the Jewish believers of the promise in Christ Jesus. The second time he uses it is in Romans 11, verse 17. He talks about the olive tree. And the olive tree is the place of spiritual blessings, and two types of branches are in the place of blessing, natural branches, which are the Jewish believers, and Gentile branches, which are the wild olive branches. And both partaking of the spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants. But now notice Romans 15, where he uses the word partaker for the third time. Romans 15, verse 25, but now I say I go unto Jerusalem and the saints who have been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who are at Jerusalem. And so far he's told us the Gentile churches in the Grecian areas here have been collecting funds to support the poor saints of the Church of Jerusalem. Now, is this only a goodwill gesture? Not at all. Look at verse 27. Yea, it had been their good pleasure, and their debtors they are. For if the Gentiles have been made partakers of their Jewish spiritual things, they ordered them to minister unto them in material things. Notice the contrast between material and spiritual. And what Gentiles partake of is the spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants. It is their spiritual things, but Gentile believers partake of the spiritual things. As he points out, that puts Gentile believers into a state of indebtedness. And the way you pay off your indebtedness is by sharing with Jewish ministries materially. So what this obligates every Gentile believer is to support a Jewish ministry. If you cannot think of a good Jewish ministry to support, there's one I can highly recommend. The obligation is here. Which one you support is between you and the Lord. I won't make this self-serving, but it does obligate Gentile believers to share with Jewish ministries materially, because Gentiles now partake of Jewish spiritual blessings. So Gentiles partake of the spiritual promises of the covenants, but not the material promises, not the physical ones. That's the distinction.
So when he puts it in his heart,
in them, he said
that,
well.
Pardon? Puts it in heart, in them,
that's the spiritual promise. So we are also indwelled by the Spirit. We also receive the new heart, new spirit, and all that. Those are all spiritual promises of the Jewish covenants, and Gentile believers partake of all of the spiritual promises. Question? Okay, wait. There you go.
That Second Chronicles, if you, my people will pray, I will heal your land, yeah. That's Jews?
That's the Jewish people, the land of Israel. It's not America. People have pulled that verse out of context and applied it to the USA, but God does not make that promise to the USA. There is only one covenant people. That's a covenantal promise, and that's promising the land of Israel will have peace and so on if the people respond. It has nothing to do with the USA or France or England or any other part of the world. So context is everything. Question?
If the Reformers, as I asked you a couple of nights ago, if the Reformers were all adherents of replacement theology, when did dispensationalism come on the scene?
Well, principles of dispensationalism was always taught as early as the second century documents we have. As far as dispensational principles, meaning that God has a future for Israel and so on, has always been taught in small groupings after replacement got the upper hand. But as a systematized theology began in the early 1800s among the Brethren movement in England and spread elsewhere in the world, in Germany especially, USA and other places. And sometimes you'll hear us criticize this as a new theology. But the opposite, covenant theology, it's only 100 years older than dispensationalism. Covenant theology, well, the replacement goes all the way back to the early church fathers like Augustine. Covenant theology as an organized theology was organized only among the Dutch reformers about 100 years previous to dispensationalism being systematized. So you have to remember, when they say dispensationalism can't be true because it's new, remind them, covenant theology began in Holland, not heaven. And the issue is not how old the doctrine is. Some doctrines are very old and very false. Baptismal regeneration is a very old doctrine, but it's a false one. Infant baptism is a very old doctrine, but a false one. Sprinkling is a very old doctrine, but a false one. The issue is the doctrine biblical, not how old the doctrine is. So doctrine could be old and false. It could be recent and true. Question? Any other questions? Any last questions? Oh, we have one? Okay, just throw it.
Kind of going off her question, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. Now, wasn't he a Gentile?
No, he wasn't.
No, he wasn't.
The word Jephunneh just means the clan he came from. It was of the Jephunneh clan, but he was a Jew of the tribe of Judah.
Okay, so he was not a Gentile.
No.
Okay.
Question? Any other questions? Back here? Well, we'll keep this guy exercised.
On a very practical note, I've had some Jewish friends, and it was just easier for us to go out to eat. But how do I don't know how you do your diet, but when you can't mix poultry and dairy together, how do you roast a chicken or a turkey?
How do you roast it?
What I'm saying is, if we're going to entertain our Jewish friends, then you know, it was always that bit of, you know, kosher kitchen. And
well, first of all, if you're not Jewish, an Orthodox Jew would never eat at your home.
We went out to dinner.
Yeah, that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
And they have to, and it has to be a kosher restaurant. If that kosher restaurant, they have to use paper plates. So I've got a hunch that if you took them out to a restaurant that was not kosher, they were not as kosher as they may have claimed to be.
That's what the kind of thing was, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if they're truly kosher, they can only go to a kosher restaurant, and they could not go to your house to eat, and they cannot go to any other restaurant to eat. And so they would have to bring their own lunch somehow.
Well, it's very difficult, though. In this area, we do have a few Jewish people
But I suspect a few are not really kosher. But if you're concerned about it, the point is, I doubt they're that kosher. But if you want to entertain them, tell them, first of all, you will get only kosher meat. And secondly, you will only use paper plates because they cannot use a dish that previously might have had a ham sandwich on it. So that's the way you would have to do it. But like again, I think the Jewish people living in this area are not going to be that kosher and not going to be that concerned about it. So if you just serve chicken or turkey on your plates, I don't think they would have a problem with it. If they have a problem with it, they'll tell you that when you invite them. But I would be suspicious that they're not really kosher in this area. You have to be in a community to really be kosher. You have a follow-up question?
Oh, no, he just doesn't live in this area.
Okay. Question? Any other questions? Your last questions? Over this way.
Where do you get the 75 days after the millennial, or after the
tribulation? It's at the end of Daniel chapter 12. The second half of the tribulation is 1,260 days. He then mentions a second figure, 1,290 days, which is an extra 30 days. He mentions a third figure, 1,335 days, an extra 45 days. So you just add the 30 to the 45, that's the 75-day period. And he points out, blessed is the one who attains the 1,335th day, because many will not attain it, but those who attain it are the ones who are going to the Messianic kingdom. Yeah.
Can you explain that at the end of the millennial reign where Satan is released upon the earth, what's the purpose of this in terms of those who've already been saved? Obviously, they can't lose their salvation, but you have. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, every dispensation is also, on one hand, a new rule of life that we live by, but secondly, a testing to see how man responds to the will of God. And the kingdom will be the best man has had since the fall, but it's not the ideal state. While sin and death is reduced and not eliminated, for example. So the test element comes in that even after 1,000 years of a perfect government, no red tape, it was Jewish government, it'll be blue and white tape, but no red tape. There was a perfect retirement benefits, everything else. In this perfect situation, with an orderly world, limited crime, no murder and other stuff, given the opportunity, the sin of man will rebel. It's not the believers that will be in that rebellion, but as mentioned, those who live born in the kingdom are given to their 100 year to believe, and if they don't believe, they are the age of 100. Now, in the last century of the millennium, many are born, many are still unbelievers. And from these many unbelievers, he gathers one last army for one last revolt against God's authority, and now bring the dispensation of the kingdom to an end. And this will be strictly a youth movement because everybody in the movement will be under the age of 100, only such as still unbelievers. And so that will be, again, showing even with that kind of a situation, the sin of man is such, he'll rebel anyway. Question over here? Isaiah 65, 20. Isaiah chapter 65, verse 20. Question?
I probably don't need a microphone. But can you comment just a minute on the temple? Because one day I asked a Jewish rabbi, and just maybe where the Jewish religion is in terms of belief of the temple, and I asked him, you know, what about the temple and being rebuilt? And he said it'll never be rebuilt. That's what the Jewish rabbi told me.
Which means he was not Orthodox. He may have been either a Reform rabbi, conservative rabbi, but he was not an Orthodox rabbi. And the conservatives and Reform don't believe in the future temple. The only ones who believe in the future temple are the Orthodox. So Orthodox rabbis, Orthodox Jews will affirm a future temple. There's a debate among them whether they build the temple first, then the Messiah will come, or Messiah will come first, then the temple will be built. But both the sides of that issue believe in the future temple. And so there will be a temple in Orthodox Judaism, but in Reform Judaism, there isn't one. That's why Reform Jews call the synagogues temples. Temple, Beit Shalom, Beit this, Beit that, temple this, because for them the synagogue is not a temple. No Orthodox synagogue will ever call itself a temple. Question? Any other questions? Any last questions? All right, let me close with several rabbi stories. Could somebody bring me an empty glass or an empty cup? An empty one. But I'll tell you two stories that come from Russia, then three stories that come from Poland. So I have five rabbi stories to close out the week, so I hope that keeps you laughing until I come back in the future. Now, the first Russian story comes from the time of the Tsars, the second one from the time of the Communists. But during the Tsarist period, the Russian military was quite anti-Semitic, and historically they would sometimes raid Jewish villages and kidnap all of the young Jewish boys from about the age of 7, 8 and force them to serve in the Russian military for 30 years before they could visit home again. And in the story, a Russian rabbi sitting in one of these cubicles in the train that would seat about 4 to 6 people. He was there all by himself because nobody else wanted to sit where a Jew sat. And suddenly the door swings open, and there was a Russian officer with the military regalia. He saw the Jew sitting there, didn't want to sit with him, so he slammed the door shut and tried to find someone else to sit. Every other seat was taken. So he could either stand, it would be a very long train ride, or he could go and sit where the rabbi sits, so that's what he decided to do. And the benches were facing each other, so the rabbi is sitting here reading his Hebrew books, and the officer is sitting here, just giving dirty looks and scowling on the rabbi. The rabbi learned to ignore these things. But after a while, the officer broke the silence and said, "What makes you Jews so smart?" Rabbi said, "I beg your pardon." And the officer says, "We officers were discussing this the other day. We noticed that the Jews are smarter than the Russians. How come you Jews are so smart?" Rabbi says, "Because we eat a lot of herring." Officer says, "Eating herring makes you Jews smart?" "Oh yes," said the rabbi. "We Jews eat herring 3 times a day. That's why we're smart. In fact, I have a jar of herring I will have for lunch so that I can stay smart." The officer asked the rabbi, "Will you sell me that jar of herring?" And the rabbi said, "Yes, you can have it for 25 rubles. And the officer gives the rabbi 25 rubles, and the rabbi gave him the jar of herring, which the officer ate up rather quickly. When he was finished, the officer said, "You know, back in Moscow, could have gotten the same amount of herring for only 5 rubles. The rabbi said, "See, you're smart already." During the communist period, there were not too many rabbis around. All the synagogues were shut down except for the showpiece they had in Moscow. And the few rabbis still there always were follow-up agents of the KGB. And this one agent that was assigned to follow this rabbi noticed every morning he went out to Gorky Park, opened up some documents with strange writings, and began to memorize it. And the officer didn't know what the documents was. He felt maybe his officers in the Kremlin should know about this. So he approached the rabbi and asked the rabbi, "What are all these documents that you read with the strange writing?" A rabbi said, oh, this is modern Hebrew. I'm trying to learn how to speak modern Hebrew. And the officer said, well, Rabbi, you're a very old man. Why are you trying to learn a new language now? The rabbi said, well, I applied for an exit visa to be able to leave Russia. And if I get the exit visa, I want to go to Israel. And they speak this language in Israel to be able to speak it when I get there. And the agent says, well, Rabbi, I already know from my contacts that they've decided to turn your request down. You will die here in Mother Russia. So you might as well stop trying to learn this new language. Oh, no, said the rabbi, I still need to learn it because if I die here, I'll go to heaven. They speak the same language in heaven. I want to be able to speak when I get there. The agent decided he'd be smart with the rabbi and said, but Rabbi, suppose you end up in hell. Rabbi said, well, that's no problem. I already speak Russian. Now, as three more stories I'll tell you as we close that come from Poland. As you know, the Jewish community has a reputation of being intelligent, and that's true. But there's one exception. There's a town in Poland called Helm, and the Jews of Helm are not known to be very intelligent. In fact, if you go to a Jewish bookstore, you'll see several books called The Wise Men of Helm. And while most Jews around the world learn to think logically through their Talmudic studies, the Jews of Helm learn to think logically by telling each other riddles. So what was the wise man of Helm? Someone who could solve every riddle brought to him. He could tell riddles nobody else could solve. And the wisest of all the wise men of Helm happened to be the rabbi. Every riddle ever brought to him, he could solve. They could tell riddles nobody else could solve. He always had this great desire to visit New York City because it had the largest Jewish population in the world back then. The most famous rabbis from his schools were in New York City. And so the Jewish community raised funds for him to take a one-month trip to New York City. So he flew into the New York City airport, JFK Airport, and was picked up by a New York taxi driver to be taken to the Jewish community about an hour and a half away. On the way, they have a conversation, and the New York taxi driver asked the rabbi, would you like to hear a riddle? And the rabbi said, do I want to hear a riddle? Why, where I live, that's all we do all day. I am the best riddle solver in my whole town. You tell me a riddle, I bet you I could solve it. And the New York taxi driver says, well, here's the riddle. My parents had a child. Now, this child was not my brother. This child was not my sister. Who could this child be? The rabbi is thinking and thinking and trying to solve it. They're getting close to where he has to get out. And he finally says, you know, I'm usually very good at this, but this is a hard one. I have to give up. Who was this child your parents had that was not your brother, not your sister? And the rabbi said, the answer is me. And the New York taxi driver says, the answer is me. I'm the child my parents had. I'm not my brother, not my sister. That's the riddle. And the rabbi says, what a wonderful riddle. I cannot wait to get back to Helm and tell my people this. They will love this riddle. After a month of traveling among the synagogues of New York City, he went back. And when the first Sabbath came, even Jews who did not attend synagogue services regularly all came out to find out about the rabbi's trip. What rabbis did he meet and what schools did he visit? When he got up behind the podium, he said, I will give you a day by the account, but first, now I was in America, I heard this tremendous riddle. Would you like to hear it first? And they all yelled out, yes, we have not heard a good riddle since you left us a month ago. Well, here's the riddle. My parents had a child, but this child was not my brother, not my sister. Who could this child be? And all this noise broadcast, they began discussing back and forth and back, trying to figure it out. And slowly the sound began to get lower and lower, and finally silence. And finally, the spokesman said, Rabbi, we couldn't figure this one out. Who was this child your parents had that was not your brother, not your sister? Rabbi said, it was the New York taxi driver met back in America. From the same rabbi from the same town. Now, the background is there was a Shabbat cup, a Sabbath cup, that you drink every Friday night, you drink the wine out of the Sabbath cup. It's often a very ornate cup and often an heirloom that was passed down from generation to generation. Rabbi had a very special Sabbath cup which he used every Sabbath that he got from his father, who got it from his father. And that was the rabbi's firstborn son to receive the cup. And the rabbi sits his son down and says, "Son, it is your turn to inherit this Sabbath cup. From now on, every Friday night, you can drink the wine from this cup as you see me do every Sabbath. But I have to warn you about this cup. Only drink from this side of the cup and never drink from this side of the cup." The son looked at the cup and said, "Well, I'm honored to receive the cup, but I don't understand. What does it matter whether I drink from this side or this side?" Rabbi said, "Listen, son, I'm a very wise man. You must listen to me. Only drink from this side of the cup. If you drink from this side of the cup, all the wine will spill all over you." That's a rabbi's story, but you can convert it to a Nike story if you want. The last one I'll tell you is also of the rabbi. The synagogue school was growing, and there were more and more kids coming. They finally had to add a new room. And so the rabbi hired some local workers from Helm to build this additional room to the school synagogue. As they were working, the rabbi decided to go out and see how they were doing. And what he noticed one worker doing is he pulled out the nail from the back and looked at it and hammered in. He then pulled out a second nail and looked at it and threw it away. So some nails he hammered in, but some nails he threw away. And finally the rabbi asked him, "Why are you throwing these good nails away?" And the man said, "Well, when I pulled the nail out of the bag and looked at it, I noticed sometimes they put their head on the wrong end of the nail, and I can't hammer in that way." Rabbi said, "No, you don't understand. These are for the other side of the building."